Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Jessica Mullins, and I'd like to welcome you to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues and social issues. Tonight, we'll discuss urban singles in San Francisco and being solo in the city. According to the 2005 census, married couples are now a minority of American households. The decline of the happily ever after narrative has given rise to a single movement that is particularly apparent in San Francisco. Our panel of experts and sexperts will shed light on the unique pleasures and pitfalls of dating and mating in the city, where single people manage to lead lives that are just as fulfilling and morally significant as those of couples. I'd like to go ahead and introduce our panelists. Formerly the Chronicle's single-minded columnist, Jane Goodall edited Single Women of a Certain Age, Stories on the Unmarried Midlife. Jane joined the ranks of Maureen Dowd and Oprah Winfrey when she was named MSN's Single Hall of Fame. Our second panelist, Sasha Kagan, is the author of Quirky Alone, a manifesto for uncompromising romantics. She's also the founder of International Quirky Alone Day, an alternative to Valentine's Day that celebrates all forms of love. She's also the founding editor of To-Do List magazine and a book by the same name that will be out in stores this fall. Our third panelist, Ethan Waters, is an author and journalist who writes about social trends. In his book, Urban Tribes, Ethan describes his quest to understand the nationwide phenomena of a generation of adults in no hurry to marry, preferring to place friendships at the center of their lives. And our fourth panelist, Ms. Emily Morse, can be heard every Saturday night on CBS Radio in a talk show called Sex with Emily. The talk show examines the seamier aspects of dating and mating, everything from manscaping to sex toys to broken hearts or broken bread frames are all fair game on the popular show. Please welcome our panel. All right, Sasha, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. What is the difference between being single and being quirky alone?
So being single versus being quirky alone, I came up with this idea of being quirky alone about 7 years ago. And the thing that irked me was that, I guess that being single didn't seem like very much of an assertion on its own terms. And so it just felt like you're basically saying I'm available. And there was this sort of like kind of pathetic feelings sometimes attached to it. And I wanted to invent a word that would put a positive spin on being single and convey an enjoyment of being single. And quirky alone was my way of doing that. Two words colliding to say that you may really want to be with someone and be a romantic at heart, but it has to be the right person, and that while you are single, you can actually take pleasure in that.
Great. And Ethan, if you could go ahead and define the term urban tribe for us.
Well, I set out to try to explain this real enormous shift in American culture, which has happened recently, which is this remarkable marriage delay that's happened among this generation of young adults. We're now the oldest marrying age in American history. And that's not just a gradual trend. That's one generation after the youngest marrying age in American history. So suddenly it's very common to spend 10, 15 years, 20 years outside a family, which is very unusual in American human history and especially for women. So I began to take a look at that and think, what were we doing with that time? And there was a tremendous amount, I knew there was a tremendous amount of anxiety out there that we were maybe wasting that time, that the standard narratives were so the friends, Seinfeld, the people who couldn't really do anything with their lives and were very concerned about and nervous about it. And so I began to look at that time period and ask the question of what were we doing, who were we devoted to, who were we giving love to. And I began to see, certainly within my own life, that it was a very tight group of friends that had taken over many of the responsibilities that normally families would have provided. and that even though this was happening to a lot of people in our generation, we weren't really seeing it because we didn't really have a narrative to sort of talk about it and speak about it. So the urban tribe was my attempt to describe this sort of evolving friendship group that often comes into our lives, sort of organically comes into our lives when we lack a family for a certain time. And that's fundamentally the urban tribe.
Thank you. Jane, I know you've done a lot of writing about women who've opted out of marriage either earlier on or later in life. Why do you think there's so many more unmarried women now?
I think there are a lot of reasons. One of probably the most important, too, is number one, urban tribes and how in big cities there's less incentive to marry right away because women are now finding out the joys of living an urban life and having a lot of friends. And the incentives to marry when you perhaps live in a more rural setting is security and financial, you know, security and physical security and all that. But we're delaying it in the big cities because of all these reasons. It's fun. It's fun to be single. And then I think the other reason is that as people divorce, you're finding a huge number of women, especially, who get divorced in their 40s and 50s, who basically say, okay, that's it for me. You know, no more marriage. I'm happy now. Who sort of they discover the joys of, say you got married at 22 and you get unmarried at 45. And yeah, it's scary for a lot of women, but then after a few years, they're kind of like, wow, I can like totally wake up on Saturday morning and not talk to anybody about what I'm going to do. Rock on. So there's that. And you know, plus marriage sucks, and that's the other reason. So. Next question.
All right. So do you guys think that all this dating that we're doing, do you think it makes us more or less adept partners if and when we decide to couple up?
Are you asking me this?
In general?
Any one of you.
I think it makes us more adept because we have more world experience, especially the people who postpone marriage until much later. I don't have the statistics to prove that, but I tend to think that if... You know, obviously, if you marry, Ethan might. But if you marry in your early 20s, you know, your relationship experience is very limited. Whereas if you marry in your mid 30s, you know, you've been around a while, you've been through relationships, you know what works for you and what doesn't.
That's exactly right. The later marriages are proving statistically to be last longer, and I think that has to do with becoming a fully formed person on your own. And also, I think if you have valuable friendships, you learn the language of love and devotion through those friendships, and that makes you, if you choose to get married, that makes you a more reliable and better partner.
I don't know. What was it? You said dating, if it's better if we're dating, do we have more experience for marriage? First of all, I just want to say that I just wish my mom was here, because I'm thinking, like, first of all, you were saying, Ethan, that you're like, we're not wasting time, really. That we're not wasting time. And I can just tell you, Mom, I'm quirky alone. and you know, everything's fine. Like, Jane, you know, we're just all not getting married. So that all feels really good. I don't know what the answer is. I think that you all have written books. I'm familiar with all of your work. And I, you know, people are waiting now longer to get married. And they are, you know, there's troubles with their, you know, trying to have kids. Or they're older and they're not sure. And their families aren't sure with what they're doing. And then people get married younger. You know, they get divorced at a younger age. I don't really have a theory on it. I just think it's interesting that we're all talking about it here.
Mm-hmm. So all this dating allows a lot more time for sexual experimentation.
True.
Do you think that San Franciscans are, on average, more experimental than elsewhere?
I know.
Or do we just talk about it more?
I'm not. That's another good question. I think about this all the time because it's my show. Everybody says, first of all, I have two things to say. The first is everywhere that people live, they say it's the worst town to date in. New York, my friends in New York, oh, it's terrible to date here. LA, this is the worst town to date in. San Francisco, terrible to date in. So I'm just going to say that everybody thinks they're in the worst city to date in. But as far as sex goes and experimentation, I do think that people here are willing to talk about it. But I also think that people say that San Francisco is a great city to hook up, great place to hook up, bad place to find a relationship. And I think there are more forms. You know, we have Burning Man, and we have, you know, Good Vibrations on every corner. Not yet, but it will be. You know, I grew up in Michigan. It was like, you know, there was like some seedy place that sold, you know, sex toys way out in the wilderness. You know, so it is a different town, and it is more, you know, I think people are more open about it. So, but you know, you go to New York, there's different sectors everywhere, but I think San Francisco is a good place to have a, you know, to do what we're doing here. Have sex or, you know, be single.
I think
maybe get married and have sex. I don't know.
I think it's a mixed bag because I think in some ways San Francisco is a really good place to date and to find a partner because there are so many single people. I mean, you just can't get around that. But on the other hand, I think that Emily's right that there's a feeling that it's a difficult place to find a relationship because of the abundance of people. And there can be this sort of consumerist mentality of, you know, don't like this one, throw them back into the pool and onto the next right. because you can. You know, I mean.
The BBD, the bigger, better deal. Have y'all heard this? Guys accuse women of, say, looking for the bigger, better deal over their shoulder, and men are accusing women accusing men. I don't know.
I have sort of an example of the anxiety that's out there. I pulled out some book titles that people are reading these days that are doing well. This is Stop Getting Dumped, All You Need to Know When, to Make Men Fall Madly in Love with You and Marry the One in 3 Years or Less. And this one is Why Men Marry Some Women and Not Others, the fascinating research that can land you a husband of your dreams. And then there's The Nice Guy's Guide to Getting Girls. And then there's Overcoming the Nice Guy Syndrome. And then for men, this is How to Be the Jerk Women Love. And then I can't say this full title, so I have to insert a word here because this is the Commonwealth Club. This is Why Men Love, we'll say witches in this case, From Doormat to Dream Girl, A Woman's Guide to Holding Her Own in a Relationship. So there's a tremendous amount of anxiety out there because of this marriage delay, with the lack of stories we have to tell ourselves about what's going on in this time. And people are really worried, and the easiest thing to do when you're really worried is to look in the mirror and think, well, there must be something wrong with me because I'm not married the way my parents were at this time in my life. And what we often forget is that this is really a generational shift. This is not just your individual life story. This is about you being part of a generation of people that are doing a number of different things, having this really for the first time, having this tremendous amount of social freedom to pick your life path during your 20s and 30s. And that means that there just hasn't been the social pressure to get married, and that means that a lot of people just haven't gotten married. But the anxiety that it might be because of you, you really have to kind of let go of that a little bit and realize that you're part of a generation that's doing this.
And I also think that this anxiety over this long single life that you're talking about, and what should we be doing? Shouldn't we be married? And there's a lot of questions out there. And I think as a result of that, there's a lot of strange behaviors on the part of single people. And I think they sort of lose their humanity in a way. I mean, I'm the geezer on the panel here. I was around in the late 60s, yes. And during the sexual revolution, it was like we were all like kids in a candy store, like, woohoo, we can sleep with 85 people this week if we want to. And it's kind of... And
we can't do that anymore?
No, we can. We can. It's just not advisable. But what we can do is online date like that. And I, writing the single-minded column for the Chronicle for 4.5 years, I heard so many tragic stories of people going to coffee shops to meet their intended match.com date and, you know, see a guy walk in and you kind of go like this and he takes a look at you and he leaves. He doesn't even say hello. I mean, it's like we're sort of experiencing that kid in a candy store phenomenon because there's so many single people and there's so many opportunities, but it kind of makes us lose track of our humanity and whatnot. And I think that really becomes a problem. When you talk about, do people become better married people from being single longer? Well, yeah, if they sort of learn how to relate to people. That's not relating to people. That's sort of like treating people like a commodity. So I sound like the old lady, but I have to raise that point. You kids today.
I think it's interesting here. I mean, you've all written about, you know, being single and now you're married, right, Ethan? But with Urban Tribe. And I think that there is that like existential angst that we have maybe for choosing to be single for a while. And, you know, are we doing the right thing and we're on this path? And women now, you know, we have, you know, careers. You know, my mother, you got married at 22, got divorced after that a few times. But we have more choices now. I attended 4 of my parents' weddings before I was 25, but that's not why I'm in this business. But no, but really, we have more choices now, but then there is a lot of my friends in their 20s and 30s now and 40s, they're thinking, I had the career, I did all these things, and I'm not sure, should I have settled down and gotten married to that guy in my 20s? But then I have a lot of friends who are, you know, married and have kids, and they're thinking, you know, these are women who worked after school, you know, out of college, went to grad school, lawyers, doctors, everything, businesses, and now they have kids, and they sort of look at my life and think, God, you're so lucky, you're single. So what I want to say is, I think it's all about just this, the universal law of suffering. Last time I was here, it was years ago to hear a speaker about, I wrote a book on Buddhism. I don't want to go all Zen on you. But I do think that single, married, I don't know, I mean, be the best person you can be and try to find the right kinds of people for wherever you're at in your life and accept it. And that, you know, you're going to be single and you're going to enjoy parts of that. And it's going to be difficult. And I know that I've never had kids, but I hear that that's the most difficult job in the whole world. And you just want to wake up on Saturday mornings and sleep in. And so, I don't know. That's my thoughts.
Do you think that part of this kind of angst has to do with unrealistic expectations? I know, Sasha, you wrote a book that's going to be coming out in the fall with people's to-do lists, and you have an entire chapter devoted to what I want in a mate. Mm-hmm. And the stories behind those lists. Were you surprised by some of those stories? And do you think that this contributes to people's dissatisfaction with either their partners or maybe their dissatisfaction with their dating lives?
So one thing I learned by collecting people's to-do lists and lists of all kinds, like to do today or to do before I die, is how incredibly common this ideal mate list is and how many people have sat in their bedrooms and written it in their diary, and mostly women, which is not a huge surprise. And they start very young in their teenage years. So, I mean, the lists are very funny. I mean, some of them have things like, I'm looking for a guy who will darn his own socks, because, you know, that's very profound. It shows that he'll care about things and not discard them. So, I mean, there are some things that are like, well, good luck finding that guy who darns his own socks. And one thing that comes up that's common in the list is this idea of a percentage and finding someone who meets a certain percentage, and 70% is usually what people are looking for. That seemed like dream man status is 70%. So, I mean, what it feels like to me is just like people are so confused and lost out there and just feeling, I don't know, I mean, a sense of optimism and vision and writing down, okay, this is my ideal partner, this is the person I want, but also just so confused. So they use these lists to sort of impose some rationality on the process, and then they get frustrated because you meet someone who meets 90% and three non-negotiables and there's no chemistry. So, it's difficult, you know? I mean, we do have high expectations because we want to find someone who is a best friend, is a great lover, is potentially a great parent, and has that zizzing factor, you know, the X factor. And
I think if we're going to talk about who's to blame, if there is a blame person or thing to blame for these high expectations, you don't have to do anything more dramatic than turn on your TV and see shows like The Bachelor and these shows where supposedly you fall in love with somebody based on, you know, 3 60-second dates or something. And the TV and the media and movies too are just full of these preposterous notions of romance, courting, and love with a capital L that leads to marriage that is no more based on anything, you know, solid than the man in the moon. But I think a lot of young girls are watching this stuff and thinking that, you know, if they could meet the prince or whatever, you know, that was the last Bachelor I watched because I had to write about it. That's my reason. You know, that's dangerous stuff out there, you know, for young people trying to sort of figure out their relationship skills. And I would also add that there's a generational thing going on here too in terms of dashed expectations, because those of us over a certain age watched Ozzy and Harriet when we were kids, and our parents, you know, there was, you know, that was what we were raised with, to think that we all lived happily ever after. And boy, you know, get married at 22 like I did, and you'll sort of learn what happiness ever after is not. So
none of it works. I don't know. I'm just listening. So you were raised with that. I mean, I guess I was sort of, or maybe till I was 8. So you're raised to think that at 22, you're supposed to, you know, you got married and have kids and you get divorced. And then we're having this long, drawn out thing of trying to figure it out. And I'm I don't even know. I don't know. I'm just thinking it's confusing. It is confusing the right way. And I'm thinking, oh, we see that everyone's watching The Bachelor now, but is it different than us watching, you know, Cinderella and reading about it? Like, is it all the same, like, iterative process?
It's all fantasy.
Right.
In some ways, I wonder.
I'm just cynical. I'm like, of course it's hard and you're not going to find it.
In some ways, I wonder if it has to do with the urban tribes phenomena that I have such great friends and I have such a level of engagement with them that finding a partner who I feel like lives up to the conversations that I have with my friends can be difficult. And so it's like, well, you have these great women's friendships, but there's no model for them to progress. I mean, it's kind of one of these interesting things we have that women are best friends, but it doesn't go anywhere in terms of commitment. And then finding a guy who matches up is difficult.
Yeah, because the bar is set very high because you have this remarkable love in your life. It's true. I mean, the number one sort of terrible story I learned about the urban tribes is the way in which urban tribes sometimes get compete with new people on the scene in terms of romantic relationships for the attention and affection of the person in the group that is falling in love with someone. And there can be sort of horrible falling outs between group of friends and new lover. So it can't, you know, I think it does raise the bar, and two, it actually can, the urban tribe doesn't necessarily lead naturally to letting someone go and letting them become, do that thing that you have to do when you fall in love, which is basically step off a cliff on your own and trust that something will happen before you hit the bottom.
Yeah. There's a fear of abandonment, I think, and it's a little bit like San Francisco, too, that, like, you have your group in San Francisco, and you fear that people are going to leave. I'm like, oh, no, they're going to leave the island and go somewhere where they can buy a house, or they're going to go, you know, get married, or, you know, so you want to keep people where they are because you like them that way.
Well, Jane, in theory, wisdom comes with age. How do you think dating
changes?
Why are you
looking at me?
You're the expert. You read a whole book about it. How does dating change in midlife? Do you think that people have more realistic expectations, that the lists get shorter, people throw their lists out?
I think the list definitely changes. I think that women my age who date are much less interested in whether a guy, you know, has a sports car and wears a bitchin' black leather jacket. I think we're much more interested in... dare I say, things of substance. You know, at least in theory at this age, you're supporting yourself. So, and maybe at this age, hopefully, if you wanted a child, you had one. So it removes those two very important reasons for getting married, you know, having a baby and being supported financially. So, in theory, at this is a golden age to date when you get over the age of 45 or 50, because you can kind of do it for the same reasons you did it in college, which is just for fun and for sex, if that's what you want. And also, your standards are higher in some ways because you're not willing to tolerate the BS, shall we say, that you tolerated as a young woman. You know what you want in a partner, and with any luck, you have a good enough set of friends, like Sasha mentioned, that you know, you don't date unless you really meet somebody that you really, really think you're going to like. So it's a mixed bag. It's more complicated. It's a little harder for women my age to get dates than it used to be. But thankfully, at this age, you're kind of, with any luck, have your life a little wired so that you don't have to worry about dating so much.
Right, and Sasha, I know you started a movement, something called the Quirky Alone Movement, and it has Quirky Alone Day, which just happens to be February 14th.
Today.
Can you tell us a little bit about Quirky Alone Day and what kind of need do you think it fills?
So I started Quirky Alone Day 5 years ago. So today is actually the 5th annual International Quirky Alone Day. And I want to say happy Quirky Alone Day to everyone. So everyone else is celebrating Valentine's Day, but you're in on the secret. So I had noticed about 5 years ago that there were all these anti-Valentine Day parties, and there was this just anti-Valentine sentiment that was strong out there. And I thought it would be fun to turn that around and to create a holiday that would be both a celebration of being single and a celebration of all the kinds of relationships and love that people have in their lives. So the first one was at Atlas Cafe, and 200 people came to that. And It was great. I mean, they've always been really fun parties because they bring people across the age spectrum, so they're just kind of unusual events with a lot of different kinds of people and different ages. And so it's grown. It's been celebrated in 30 cities around the world since then, as far away as Sydney and New Delhi and London. And people get together on quirkyalone.net, which is my website, and there's message boards, and they coordinate to set up their Quirky Alone Day parties. And sometimes get together at other times of the year, too, as an ongoing social group. It fills a need for people, especially people who don't live in San Francisco or New York or Seattle, where they feel pretty isolated in their town. So it's a place where they can go and find people who aren't married, basically, and have some community. But it's also a day you can celebrate by yourself. So you could go to a spa, you could go to a Pilates class, buy yourself new underwear. It's just like do something good for yourself.
So Quirky Alone and Quirky Alone Day started in San Francisco, mm-hmm. here in San Francisco, but it is sort of a uniquely urban phenomena. And what is that kind of urban environment that lends itself to Quirky Alones? How does that impact people's dating lives? How do you think dating here is different than elsewhere?
How is dating different?
I think there are a lot of group dates, not group dates, but I mean, my daughter's 28, and she informs me that at that age group, at least, it's like they kind of young people sort of hang out these days, and it's like, you know, they go, they may be interested in a guy, but then they'll go out with, you know, three or four people just to, you know, that's kind of normal. At my age, it's still kind of the standard, you know, call up, make a date. But at the younger age group, don't you think that's Quirky Alone? Don't you think that's kind of urban?
I think if it's handled well, it can be. I think I've handled it poorly, and people are really mad. But yeah, I think that can be Quirky Alone. Like, meet the parents is meet the friends, and it happens on the second or third date.
That's right.
And let's see, what other ways is dating different?
I can say I talk to a lot of people in San Francisco about dating. And like I said, everywhere is bad. Everywhere you live is the worst place to date. But there are trends in San Francisco. And this comes up all the time. Lots of women here, many, say men just do not ask you out in San Francisco. And this is something I hear over and over again, that they'll say, you know, I was in New York, or people live in New York, they move from San Francisco to New York, like, everyone asks you out. Guys just come up to you and they ask you out. In Los Angeles, same thing. But San Francisco, this is the one consistent truth men, for some reason, they feel, don't approach, and it is more of the friends. Like, hey, so there's this event happening tonight, and maybe we could meet up, we'll meet around there, I'll be with my friends if you want, or I'll just text you if I'm there. But if I'm not there, you know, I might not text. I'll send out six texts and see who answers. So, I mean, I think there's sort of a more of a flakier, non-committal dating scene that I've heard of in San Francisco.
I think technology affects a lot of it, and that's text messaging and online dating and hyper-dating online, just like bam, 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 mm-hmm. so many people. And, yeah, that text message flakiness, I think, is definitely true.
I think there's a lot of that. That's what I've heard.
Sasha, so you just mentioned the issue of technology and how that plays out in all of our relationships. Do you guys think that, on the balance, technology is a benefit to dating aspirants, or do you think it's just a distraction?
I don't know about a distraction, but, you know, not to hype on my previous inhumanity slogan, but, you know, right in the years of writing my column, I heard about numerous like breakups by text message. Like people who'd been seeing each other for several months get a text message, it's not working, you are too uncool, like two or something, bye bye. And I think if you're into hyper dating, that's a good word, you know, where you do like volume dating, then probably it helps because then you can just quickly, you know, crank them out. But, I didn't mean it that way. But I don't think it certainly adds to our interpersonal skills.
Yeah, I think a lot about that, about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, because I do think there's this callousness with which we can sort of discard people and not be that polite to them. And it's just the volume of emails you get. Like, it's just hard to respond to everything, but it doesn't really feel great. I also think that we've just become shyer in person, and I think what Emily says is true, that people don't ask each other out in person, and that's because we can rely on online dating. We can just, you know, go to the event, not talk to anyone, go home, be in the safety of your living room, and prowl online, and that's what people do. But on the other hand, I'm glad those websites exist now, because there was a way in which before they did that I sort of felt marooned and like there were no options. So I don't know. I feel really mixed about it.
About technology and dating. I mean, I think, again, it helps. You can email, you know, you can email, no, he's a good writer. He has lots of spelling errors. I'm not going to, you know, go with this person, or his grammar's not great. And so you can rule people out. Rather than, I mean, I'm still a fan of like the meeting someone and the energy, or, you know, we're in Northern California, the energy and the feeling you get when you meet someone. I've not dated online, but, you know, it's like anything. I guess it does increase your odds, your chances of meeting somebody if you have, you know, I know people who, you know, they do the speed dating thing, or they have a lunch date and a dinner date, like 11 dates in a week. You need like to track it or something. You need like a tracking system. And so if you're going to meet more people, and therefore if the internet's helping you meet more people and you're authentically connecting with these people as you're with them and it works for you, that's great. But I think that some people can kind of use it as an excuse and hide behind it and maybe get, you know, rule people out before they should because of certain things that, you know, text messaging helps people hook up, I think, definitely at night. I don't know if that's good or bad. Whatever your position is on that, I think that there's a lot of like late night, you know, at least that's what people are talking about. I don't know if they actually seal a deal, but a lot of friends, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, they're sending text messages about, you know, you home, be home in 10 minutes. Yeah. Good or bad, it depends what you're looking for. I don't judge.
Well, so Jane, you just mentioned people who found very profoundly inhumane ways to break things off. What's the right way to break up with someone?
Yeah, it's a whole nother panel,
right,
I think. The right way to break up with somebody, I would think just in person. You know, that's really my only, you know, suggestion. Like if you want to be kind. Or over the phone, I suppose. But the text message thing, just I thought that was very, very, very cold.
Yeah, it should be an honest dialogue. I mean, it can be, a breakup can be as complicated as getting together was. I mean, I think it sort of rises to the level of the relationship, I think.
Or sinks.
Yeah, exactly.
Then again, quickly. if it was only a one-night stand.
Band-aid, just rip it off. I think the sooner the better. I mean, I don't know. I think people stay in relationships for a long time. I think if you get present with what you want, and the sooner you know that things aren't working, I think it's a trend, too, that we have more people to be dating. People aren't getting married and settling down as much. And sometimes you just maybe stretch things out and then just be honest, keep open dialogue. Communication is a lubrication. If you communicate more, you might have better sex as well. And just be honest. There's a bug flying here. Okay.
Yeah. So another issue with breakups and breakup etiquette, when you break things off with someone, what's the fairest way to divide up the restaurants and the friends and the places where you guys used to hang out?
Case-by-case basis. To break up the rest, I mean...
I was going to say, yeah, it depends on how long you were with that person. If you were married or, you know, if you were with them for years, it's very, very complicated. And, you know, friends inevitably get drawn into the vortex. But I don't know. I don't know if there's any one good way to do it. I really think it has to be just case by case. I've been divorced twice. The first one was hell. The second one was easy. So, you know,
good
just,
at it.
Yeah, I've gotten very good at it. Too bad I'm never marrying again. Yeah.
Well, what if it's just a casual relationship or a one-night stand? What kind of obligations do you have, if any?
Obligations. I think I'm old-fashioned. Call. If you sleep with someone, you should at least call.
To
is that
say
you mean
what
one-night
exactly?
Stand? I'm gonna go with the one-night stand thing. I think it's always nice, you know, no matter who should call, man, or be in touch. I don't know. Unless you had agreed beforehand, it's a one-night stand, we're not going to talk. But usually we want a call. Women. I'm going to speak for women. We want a call, unless you don't want it and you made it clear and you didn't leave your number. You gave a fake number. Then that's cool. You don't have to be like the FBI to find you. But what's the protocol? I don't know. Is that what you're...
Well, Ethan, I can imagine that if you're sort of dating within your tribe, that that comes with a whole bunch of complications. What's the best way to handle it if you date and then cease to date?
It's a terribly difficult thing. And in fact, there, you know, urban tribes often, these groups of friends often have rules within them that you'll not start dating with someone in the tribe because...
I thought they all sleep together in the tribe.
No. That's a common...
Different tribe.
No, there's a spectrum of different...
Okay, got it.
There's different tribes. On one end, everyone sleeps together. On the other end, people see it as a real potential problem because they, you know, most relationships do not go on forever. And when two people within the group that everyone's, these tribes are very highly clustered, by which I mean that it's not just one friend in the middle with a group of friends sort of surrounding them, but everyone is interrelated. They all are friends with each other. So when two people in the group date and then break up, it causes tremendous pain to a lot of the friends in terms of if the breakup is acrimonious. So a lot of groups really try to forestall it by heading it off before it happens, you know, to keep people from, basically by saying to the people involved, it's like, you better be really serious about this because you're dating, you know, your good friend who's my good friend and everyone you know is a good friend. And if you are not in this for the long haul, back off because it's potentially very bad for us all.
And sometimes, even if you're not in close social proximity to someone, after you break things off with them, it can still be awkward because you can still sort of know what people are up to with websites like Friendster or,
Good Lord, yeah.
You know, the website Google. So, do you think that kind of online research? Do you think that that's constructive or destructive?
That's a road towards madness for sure. I mean, absolutely. And I know, you know, I'm out of the demographic that does this, but I do. You know, I teach students that are of this age, and I hear these horror stories of people being, watching their ex-partner's, Facebook page or whatever it is, or MySpace page, constantly to see what they're doing and who they're talking to. And jealousy is just is the most sort of pernicious and awful human emotion. It comes up out of the stem of our brains, like a lizard brain. You know, it's this horrible thing that you just can't not feel when you feel it. It's an awful, awful thing. And lots of things can trigger this. Certainly seeing, you know, being the places you were together or the people you were friends with, but also all these electronic representations of the person in your past can be triggers to that sort of jealousy. And it's terribly hard for some people to deal with. It's a real problem.
Yeah, I think it's an addiction. I mean, it's actually a really bad thing because you can get addicted to it, like looking every day. In the Quirky Alone book, I have a chapter on romantic obsession, and there are certain diagnostic signs of your romantic obsession. That's like you meet someone, and it's amazing, and it's great, and it's like the beginning of a movie, and then it's over like a week later, and you're like, what happened? I thought that person was my soulmate. And so then you go into a state of romantic obsession, and one of the ways you know is if you're re-Googling someone like every day. But yeah, I think it can be really bad. I mean, you can find your ex-boyfriend's wedding pictures online and look at them every day. I mean, that's not a good position to put yourself in. And because it's there, people do.
You need your tribe to pull you away from your computer if you're doing that.
I was going to say, then again, you know, I heard from several people who were dating online for whom Google was an excellent resource because, you know, they would meet somebody online and they'd Google them and find out some him or her and find out some awful thing, you know, and go, oh my God, you know. And so, yeah, it's you just, I think you have to govern your own behavior. You know what I mean? It's like it can be not your friend if you become obsessed with it. But I know a lot of people who've Googled people with very good results. So
Google goggles. I heard this term. Google goggles.
Google goggles.
It's from a book by Chronicle Books actually called Rex Sex. And there's all these terms for... And Google goggles are when you Google someone and it's really good. Like you find out like, wow, he's got a book in the Amazon top 20. Or, you know, she's, you know, has this amazing job. And that's a good Google. If you Google...
Well, there's many things that people do obsessively on the internet. And in 2003, the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, more than half of them said that the internet played a significant role in divorces in the past year, and that online porn contributed to half of these cases. Do you think that pornography can be used to create intimacy, or is the objectification of sex and sexuality inherently destructive to intimacy?
I mean, I think porn can definitely be used to, pornography can help to, can create intimacy, but like anything to excess, you know, is a problem. Anything, you know, you eat carrots every day for breakfast or something, and that's all you drink, and like that's a problem, you know. You Google a million times, that's a problem. Not that it was you doing that. No, but I think pornography, I mean, I've learned that pornography is, you know, what, and in relationships, if you're open and you're intimate, that comes up a lot. I have listeners, you know, all over the country that email me. It's a podcast as well. And they're like, you know, men and women, I have this porn, and I don't know if my wife, for example, wants to watch it. And how do you talk to her? They fear women. A lot of women, I don't mean to stereotype, but they do maybe have more fear around it, and men can too. But women are like, oh, it's scary. I don't look like that person. And then I've seen a lot of issues where couples have used it in a constructive way, where, you know, he can go take her shopping online, and she can show him what her fantasies are. And there's porn now that you can find that's like tailored towards your individual fantasy. And there's ways to, it doesn't have to just be whatever porn you find when you turn on, you know, cable. It can be, you can find stuff that actually works, and anything that helps people communicate and have better sex, I think, can, you know, is a good thing. Yeah.
So of course,
it can be destructive, but, you know, I'm saying the good parts.
Like the carrots. Right. We're going to go ahead and take questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have questions for any of our panelists, you can go ahead and start lining up at the microphone. So a lot of what you guys have described tonight, in terms of being single and dating, it's not an altogether pleasant experience. What do you think is the best way to manage your single life and have it be as productive and enjoyable as possible?
I think that having a happy single life is almost as difficult as having a happy married life. It's just different. You have to be responsible for your own happiness. You don't just get to, you know, wake up on Saturday morning and go, yippee, I can go to the flower market and have that be a fulfilling life. I think it's incumbent on you to network and to kind of build a network of friends. And because really, truly, one of the biggest downsides of being single is not having somebody there, say, when you're sick. You know, everybody gets sick. And if you want to talk about miserable, you know, talk about being sick and single in a, maybe in a new town or something like that. So, you know, you got to work it. You got to meet people. You got to find, you know, and if I would get endless emails from people to my column that were lonely, and I'd say, well, what else do you care about besides your job at the bank? Do you love animals? Go join the PETA, or, you know, go to, you know, if you love the ballet, join the ballet auxiliary. Or, like, find things that you're passionate about and get involved in the world. And that does two things. When you get involved in the world, something outside of yourself, it keeps you from being lonely because you feel like you're contributing something. And also, you meet other people that are similarly disposed. So that's my pep talk, at least.
What about the rest of you guys? What's a recipe for dating or single happiness?
I mean, again, I think it's, you know, have a happy life, do what you want to be doing. And I think, again, yeah, married, single, I think there's pleasure, you know, pleasure to it and great pain. But if you are single, this is some good tips I've heard. This is like the bet I've been doing this show for. I've talked to, you know, lots of people for my show and emails and stuff. And people say that they can't meet anybody. They're like, God, there's nobody. I just can't. You know, I've tried. I've gone online. And it's interesting to say, like, what have you really, how many times have you left the house this week and done something a little bit different? Did you talk to anyone on the bus? Did you smile at that guy that you saw was cute? Okay, no. Did you, you know, okay, you see your same friends every night. You know, what can you go to a, you know, there's tons of single events in the Bay Area for, like, everything, like single, like, knitters and horseback riders. I'm serious. And so it's like, just do one thing. I always say, like, just do one thing this week that's a little different where you might meet someone or say something. You know, I think a lot of times we hold ourselves back in our minds. We're like, oh, he won't like me. She won't like me. She probably, a lot of guys do this. She's a boyfriend. I know she's a boyfriend. I'm not going to ask her. I'm sure. And we like talk ourselves out of approaching. And so I think there's a lot to just, you know, even doesn't have to be that you just want to sleep with the person, but just making new friends, reaching out. I don't have no success to being the answer to being happy, but just, you know, being out there and being yourself in all situations.
Sasha, Ethan?
I think that Emily makes a good point. I had this thing called the boldness campaign, which I was writing about, which is sort of what Emily was describing, was just doing something new that sort of pushed you out of your comfort zone. And I think that being single in particular lends itself to that, because you have the time to amuse yourself, so you do have the opportunity to kind of grow and push yourself and take risks. And the other thing I wanted to mention is I think that when people are single and they're looking for a partner, there's a way in which the search mentality can seep into every moment of your life, and you can just feel like, oh my God, like I'm every moment looking for someone, and it becomes really depressing because it's sort of overcoming and desperate feeling. So I think there's sort of a tricky way that you have to manage that like, okay, yes, I'm looking for someone, and as you get older, I think you have to value that and say it's okay, like that it doesn't just happen magically. I think you sort of have the luxury of feeling that way when you're 24, but it's okay to put effort into meeting someone, but that you kind of have boundaries around it, so it's not like every waking moment in the grocery store, you know, like, I don't know, I'm enjoying getting this broccoli, and it's not like just so I can meet someone across the produce aisle. It just can become too much, and I don't know about men, but I think for a lot of single women, it can become like just too filtrating of every moment.
I think you can also, you know, hopefully you can let go of the anxiety that surrounds the marriage delay now, that you know that this is sort of a generational thing. You can tell your mother to stop bothering you, because this is not just you. This is what people of your age, if you're college educated and moved to a big city, in all likelihood you're getting married after 30, and there's a huge range of when people get married, full, you know, 20, 25 years, where it's fully acceptable to get married anytime in that time. If you were actually looking for a mate, I do think there's this fascinating social psych paper that talks about the strength of weak ties, which is that to do anything complicated in the city and to get that information that you need to do something like find a job or find a mate, the best way to do it is to look not to your friends, because they'll all have the same information, but sort of to the network, that the shadowy network of people that you almost know, that's just beyond your group of friends. So it's the friends that your friends know that you haven't met yet. And the more dynamic you make your close group of friends, the more dynamic that those weak ties are going to be. And that's, you know, most of the love stories that I hear work out in the city are ones where you find the person in that network that's just beyond your perception.
Great, thank you. All right, we're going to go ahead and open up to questions. Please be sure and keep your questions short so we can get to as many as possible. For the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking about urban singles in San Francisco and being solo in the city. I'm Jessica Mullins, Inforum advisor, and I'm here with Jane Ganahl, author of Single Women of a Certain Age, Sasha Kagan, founder of the Quirky Alone Movement, Ethan Waters, author of Urban Tribes, and Emily Morse of Sex with Emily. Now let's go to the audience for questions.
Okay, I'll try to make this as short as possible, but it's kind of convoluted. So I'm a member of an urban tribe, I would say. I have a very strong group of friends. And one thing that always comes up for me is that I've never really considered myself to be delaying marriage. I did read your book, and I think it's great. And it wasn't about delaying it, but more like maybe redefining it in a way that is only like, I don't want to do it unless it's with somebody who understands that. And it seems like every time people talk about being single or being married, there's this like big divide, as though your life ends when you get married and suddenly your life doesn't belong to you anymore. And I don't know that I buy that. I'm just wondering, how is there more of a balance between like, you know, having a life that expands your whole life, and these are just different phases, and it doesn't define your life what relationship you're in, whether it's not or in a marriage. You know?
What do you guys think?
Well, I can tell you in terms of that the perception of there this being this huge divide that you walk out of the urban tribe and to the altar, and then you enter a new life. You know, I have heard of cases where that is sort of true. People move away and have kids, and they don't see their friends anymore. But for the most part, and it's been true for me after writing the book and getting married, and I have two kids now, that if you live for 15 or 20 years and your friends are your social support and they do all these wonderful things for you, it doesn't end. In fact, you find remarkable new things and new challenges to do together. You buy property together. You open businesses together. You start creative co-ops together. There's any number of ways you can up the ante when your friends at one point were just about getting by in the city and finding an apartment and finding a job and finding a mate. And now the challenges of middle life childcare, you know, your profession, are every bit as and more challenging. And if you've learned to rely on your friends and you've identified your friends as a social support in your life, they will be there for you as you grow older. And that's, and I think, but I think they'll only be there if you recognize what they are at the time that you're single and give them credit for being there and give them credit for being something not transient, but something very real.
That's what I call the quirky together way. And I mean, my friends who were quirky alone or very into that mindset, now that they've gotten married, it doesn't really seem like their lives are any different. I mean, they still, I mean, one friend in particular who's like, we consciously bought this apartment because it has two floors, so he can be here and I can be here, and he's, you know, 500 miles away half the time, and she's still hanging out with her friends and hanging out by herself. But it does seem to me like the real dividing line, if you're in that sort of quirky together group, is not single or married, but childless or with children. So, I mean, it seems entirely possible to get married and have your life continue mostly the same.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know if you guys had ever looked at the dating issues of interracial couples. I'm from New York originally, and it wasn't too much of a issue with black and white couples, but I find that out here in San Francisco, there's a slight edge and there's a slight look about it that I found is a little bit more difficult. It's I wondered if you guys ever came across any of that.
I never got any feedback with my writing my column about that difficulty. I did get some email about Asian American and Anglo American couples, but no, not really.
I haven't either. I mean, no more than you would. I feel like there. I haven't seen that singled out. Is there conflicts between, you know, there are conflicts between groups. I haven't noticed that there was that. I've never come to my attention that there were. And I feel like I have a lot of friends who are interracial in San Francisco dating. Yeah.
I've thought a little bit about this in terms of the urban tribes, because the marriage delay does tend to happen among college-educated people that move to cities. Oftentimes, the tribes can begin to form in college, which makes them kind of often socioeconomically and racially not diverse. They go to the cities. And two things can happen, and I don't have one great answer, but the two things that happen is, one, they sort of wall themselves off from other people coming into the group, and that's doesn't seem to be the healthiest type of urban tribe. And the other type does become as diverse as the city landscape. And those, honestly, in my mind, were the tribes that sort of seemed the most vibrant and healthy. They actually had mechanisms by which new people could come into the group, and that new person, and when they did that, they tended to become remarkably diverse groups, both racially and socioeconomically.
I just think it's interesting to talk about your experience, though, because I think there is everyone always talks about San Francisco, so diverse, so diverse, so diverse, and then, you know, it's like you always don't even hear if there's a problem. Like, not in San Francisco, so, you know, I just feel like everyone's like, we're all getting along, everything's happy, everything's good, but I'm totally, you know, you've had your friends have had experiences, you know, I think there's probably merit to that, but people here don't, it's like, it's a beautiful city, and we're really diverse, and there's no issues in that. Wow. That's what people say. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Thank you all. It's a great panel. And Ethan, actually, someone, a friend of mine gave me your book several years ago, and I generally don't remember the books I read, but that is, in fact, one of them. And I've recommended it to several folks because I felt like I was reading about my own life here. My question for all of you up here, and Emily, I'm a fan of your show as well,
nice.
But my question is, as we get older, I'm in my late 30s, and we touched on a little bit, and Ethan in particular, I don't know if you've seen additional research since you wrote Urban Tribes, but people become more settled in their ways, right? And as far as dating is concerned, and it gets back to some of the things, Sasha, you said about the acceptance level and deal breakers and things like that, but I was just curious, have you seen, you know, people sit there and they say, I have a friend who's in a cross-country relationship, and neither one of them wants to move. They're both in their 40s, they've got their lives, their tribes, and respective things. I just wondered maybe if you've seen something, Ethan, in further research in this regard, or if anyone else on the panel sort of commenting on that issue of, as we get older and we get more settled, are we becoming less open to the possibility of relationships with different folks?
I would say definitely, being the geriatric person on the board here, I think one reason people that get older date less is because maybe not because their list is so long, but because, you know, they've been on a lot of dates and they know now, you know, what they're more settled in what it is that they want to deal with or put up with or whatever. So, and I've also heard of many happy relationships where people live on into senior hoods in different houses, you know, that they continue to have relationships because that works really well for them. And I think as you get older, you discover that your version of a great relationship doesn't have to fit into the, you know, Bachelor TV show. I mean, it can be all kinds of different, you know, frameworks.
And I like this. I like Sasha Quirky together because I think that is kind of the movement that's happening. A lot of us are single and dating a lot longer. And you do get set in your ways, which I think is a good thing. Like, because a lot of people, I think, are the people who feel all the, you know, angst around the fact that they're not married, that there is this pressure, and that if you're older, you're set in your ways, then you can kind of create your own kind of relationship. There is this kind of pressure, like, to blindly, I always see people blindly sign up for monogamy. And like, it's okay, we're going to get married, we're never going to look at anyone else, we're going to have live together, and we're going to become one. And I think that if we do have independence, we're, you know, in our 30s, 40s, and we're single, why does it make sense that we're going to want to live together and become one? There's a book out now, Mating in Captivity. I don't know if anyone's read this book, but it's an amazing book, and it talks about how, you know, that maybe that notion's wrong, that we're all supposed to do this one thing together and that it's okay to have your independence. And maybe that's what keeps sex alive in relationships when there is a little separateness, and that the drive to become one might not be working specifically in the bedroom. And that, I think, helps in turn relationships. But that's my take.
I think the urban tribe can, one of the sensations of being involved in one is sort of a drift of time. Like, you really don't have any clear time markers, and 5, 10, 15 years can sort of go by, and you haven't, and it's sort of that you're living almost the same life. It's a very similar sort of thing. So you can't, sometimes you don't, and one thing you have to do, I think, in order to get into a meaningful relationship, I said before that it can, urban tribe can combine with a meaningful relationship, but I think there's a period first where you have to sort of step away from the group of friends and say, you know, basically, this is a risk I have to take without you guys. You guys can't be there as my safety net if I'm going to devote myself to this new relationship. I have to try this on my own, and I have to step away for a little bit. You step away, you devote yourself to that relationship, and if then you kind of redefine the us in your life into that smaller unit, and then you could bring your friends back into that partnership. And oftentimes wedding ceremonies these days are really lovely events because the friends come together and throw the wedding, and it's almost as if the wedding ceremony now has a new meaning for our time, which is acknowledgement of the primacy of the couple, in, you know, that the friends are honoring, and also the fact that the friends are going to be there to support that group. So, it, you know, the urban tribe can be a barrier to getting into relationships. It can be the thing that connects you to that, you know, weak tie out there that is the relationship. It can be the jealous other partner. It can do a number of things, but they're actually very difficult. It's a very difficult thing to navigate, you know.
Thank you.
I had a question with regard to Emily, a comment that you made. You spoke about women in San Francisco complaining of the fact that men are not willing to ask them out. And I've had the opposite experience just myself, because I'm a person who's happy to ask women out and do it frequently. I did it a few times tonight. it didn't go well, but that's another story. That's not true.
I didn't do it here. Take an ember, ladies.
but I have do it, and I'm done it. I'm happy to do it. What I found, though, probably more often than not, and this is my question, there's almost a veneer of the ability to take care of oneself. And so you're in a setting where a woman is, you know, enjoying her Kettle One and soda, and you approach her and make some whatever nice comment, and it's met by, I'm here drinking with my friends. Oh, sorry. I mean, you're enjoying your Kettle One and you look fantastic, and clearly, or and maybe you're in alone, but clearly you're not here to have a conversation with somebody. So That's frustrating, and I've actually found that fairly common. So is there can you talk to that?
That's interesting. What's your approach? Okay, let's say I'm sick now.
I'm usually super drunk, and they're the bartender.
See, I can't say here. No, but there is a certain, people do say that people in San Francisco, that the men don't ask out, the women are really independent, and everyone's in their urban tribes, and they're kind of, they go out in cliques.
Right.
And that they're actually not interested in being asked out, and that people do know everyone they want to know. And so I have heard that as well. But I also need to know what you're saying.
Well, I mean,
people.
Assuming that my approach is is reasonable, Jessica might be able to speak to it better than I can, maybe critically. But assuming that it is reasonable, I'm just kind of wondering where that ultra self-sufficiency sort of veneer, where that might come from. Because from even a 5,000-foot view, you know, there's a prevailing sense of loneliness probably amongst many, many people, and that conversation or that relationship that could prevail from it could be terrific if it were allowed to be had. And I feel like much like people who online date are sort of the hyper daters, and then
right.
don't take something, you know, don't meet someone because they knock them out of the box before they, you know them. Same type of situation. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting thinking about, like, the weak ties. If San Francisco is cliquey, let's say, people say that, and that people go out in groups and they're not as, you know, women aren't as receptive if you are asking them out, which is good, and you should still do that. I guess I'm not even saying the traditional bar situation, but if you have friends and friends of friends and they're having a party and there's a woman there that you find attractive, you know, that's not the kind of woman. You know, if you're at a party in someone's house or in a club, they're not going to turn you down.
Correct.
Even if you have a really bad pickup line. Because they're friends, because you're friends with this guy here and you went to school together. So I think there's more of like hangout environments where there's, you know, people that you know and doing things that you love.
Yeah. I think most people will be flattered. I mean, it's hard to speak to your individual experience, but I mean, people want a story. Like they may go out in a pack with their friends, but they want something to happen. That's why people go
right.
to bars. And so, I mean, it doesn't really matter if you wind up going on a date, if you wind up getting married, just to have something to talk about, something that happened is fun. So, I mean, I would say don't stop.
Don't stop.
Just keep going.
Don't stop.
Don't stop.
Do you have
stop.
Dinner plans? Thanks.
There's your answer. All right, we have time for one more question.
Okay, I'm going to phrase this question provocatively, just for the fun of it. My question is it biochemically possible to be happy if you're single? Where I'm coming from in asking that is that I'm a science writer, so I read a lot of scientific papers, and there's a growing consensus that the human body needs the sustained intimate physical contact with other bodies in order to maintain its own metabolic functions. Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of y'all know this instinctively, and science is just beginning to figure this out, but I think that's an important question because we have this discourse in our society that you're supposed to be happy even if you're single. Then you can only find someone else if you are already happy within yourself. And of course, there's a great deal of truth in that, but I think that is leaving out a huge part of the picture that we are just beginning to figure out, that we actually do need that sustained physical intimate contact with other bodies in order to maintain our own metabolic functions. And hookups don't count because it's not sustained. That's why you have this staggering rate of depression in the younger set. So I'd just like your observations and your thoughts on that. Is it possible to be happy when you're single because of the biochemistry of the way the human body reacts?
It is.
Wow.
It depends. It's a good question. It depends on what you mean by the word single. Now you're talking in terms of having a sustained sexual partner over time, and I would think like, well, let's expand what we mean by being together. You know. If you have an intimate group of people in your life that includes very close physical proximity, daily, you know, communication and support, touching, perhaps even, you know, actual sexual gratification and on different levels, does that count as that other thing that we're talking about, the thing that humans need? Clearly humans need that. If you sit in alone in a room and you are literally, not figuratively, single by yourself, you will have a very sad and life, you know, filled with mental illness. I mean, it's not. But there are other ways to get human affection and touch and kindness besides a romantic partner, and that's what I think we've too narrowly defined when we've thought about this issue.
I think it's a really interesting question, and there are many different social manifestations now that speak to this need, and you have like the cuddle party phenomena, so mm-hmm. you know, people coming together just so they can have supposedly non-sexual cuddling. I've often thought about this, and I've thought about going to get massages as this like kind of just huge human need, and that if you're a single woman, it's not really paying for sex, but in a way it kind of is, because you're like paying for something that you really need, and it's not as messy as a one-night stand, where that's kind of a cheap and dirty way of, or, well, not necessarily, but I mean, it can feel that way. So sometimes it just feels more clear and has more integrity to get a massage. And then I think that you have friends that sometimes are more comfortable with physical touch. Some people just don't like that, you know, and they only want to be physically touching their romantic partners. But I have certain friends that you can kind of, like, you know, just lie your head in their lap. And I actually feel better after hanging out mm-hmm. with those people, you know. I mean, it makes a big difference. So, I mean, I think it would be nice if more people felt that way, if we could kind of, like, in other cultures, girls will walk down the street holding hands when they're friends, you know, and that's nice. And we just have a lot of taboos around that. It would be nice to break that down, because I do think it's a need.
I think to answer your question, I do think it is possible to be happy as a single person. But I do also agree that that's a very primordial instinct, is to want to bond with people, not just emotionally, but physically. And I agree that, you know, I mean, some of my happiest nights are maybe not with a guy, but if, say, my daughter's visiting and we flop out on the couch and watch a movie, and she puts her feet on my lap, and, you know, there's just that sort of, it's like the cuddle party thing. I don't know if you guys have heard of these things, but it's kind of genius, where people come together and just cuddle. Just cuddle. I don't know. I guess it works. I don't think I'll ever be going to anything like that. But I do think that we need to also think not just in terms of having prolonged partners, but, you know, finding other ways of expressing affection for each other physically.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think a lot of people, the single and married, I don't know how you really divide it. If that's how could you, you know, what are the control factors? Because what about someone's overall happiness throughout their lifetime? I think that that's more likely predetermined, or how your, you know, your serotonin levels and your dopamine. They say when you fall in love, your dopamine spikes. It's like you're, you know, you're really in love, and then it crashes, or you're, you know, it's a side, like, looks like you're going crazy, right? The same brain chemistry is firing. Like you are falling in out of love. So there is a certain spike. There's a certain thrill, like you're saying, you're dating and it goes up and down. But then there's also that the long term of being in a relationship as well. People tend to be the same, you know, again, like their happiness levels or their whatever their levels are throughout their lifetime, that no matter what happens to them, you tend to be predisposed. So I'm not sure if you can really break it down into, that's what I've heard, single and married. It's kind of like,
right, and
how are you without, yeah, your lifetime? What's a spectrum?
How many married people do you know that are actually having sex anymore?
Yeah, exactly. See, I just, I think, yeah, like I said, everyone's suffering in some way, but I don't see it divided that way.
Everyone's suffering in some way. I think we're going to have to go ahead and end there.
It's true. And everyone's happy. We're happy, too. We're really happy.
Please give our panelists a big hand. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum is adjourned.